very, very informative. The question that I have is that is still somehow unclear to me. When you have a maximum voltage, there is a potential. When you have a maximum current, there is a flow. So at that point, if we have a maximum voltage, it's like we have an outlet in the wall, and that outlet has a potential of 110 volts or 220. Then when we have a zero voltage, we're talking about the sending wave, then we have a maximum current. And most of the questions that people ask me is, how come it is possible that we have a flow of electrons when there is a zero voltage on it? And to exist.
You got to be careful about these so-called zeros. In the case of a transmission line, if I've got an open circuit at the far end, which means I've got a perfect reflected signal, an infinite standing wave ratio, or I could call it rho. The Greek letter rho represents the voltage reflection coefficient. So a complete open circuit gives you a rho of unity. The signal flowing back down the cable has the exact same magnitude as the voltage of the signal flowing up the cable. If I put 1 volt into the signal generator, the signal generator is generating 1 volt into the cable, and the far end of the cable has a open circuit, then the signal that's generated at the far end of the cable that reflects back will be also 1 volt. A reflection coefficient, which is the Greek letter rho, is 1 volt. There are certain key positions on that particular cable where the forward going 1 volt and the reverse going 1 volt come together. When you put a voltage sensing device across the cable, which means that you are mixing the forward going signal and the reverse going signal together for the first time, you are doing that mix when you put that instrumentation there, because it's a non-directional voltage sensing detector. You see the forward going 1 volt, you see the reverse going 1 volt, and they mix together in your instrumentation, and you will see 2 volts. And at that point, you will think that when you put a current sensing device there, which is non-directional again, you'll think there is zero current. There isn't zero current. There really is a signal flowing to the right, which has a known amount of 1 volt and 1 ampere, we'll say, if it's a 1-ohm cable. And there's a signal flowing to the left, which has got 1 volt and 1 ampere. And at certain positions on the cable, the constructive voltage gives you 2 volts. The destructive voltage gives you 0 volts. A quarter wavelength away.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Dick, you didn't explain the zero voltage and the maximum current scenario. Theoretically, we came to that point. How can we have a current?
Comment, Dick.
John recognized, I'm going to go to you in a second. The point where the current is maximum and the voltage is minimum.
Zero. Say zero. Theoretically, we have a zero voltage and maximum current. Two wires are the twin leads. We have a 180 degrees out of phase between the current. That's what we had on that drawing that I have sent to you. How come we have a flow when we have no voltage? There is no power.
Not true, Dick.
There is real energy flowing from left to right, in my example. There is real energy flowing from right to left. The net result is nearly zero. The open circuit at the far end absorbed no energy. It absorbed no power. Energy was flowing in two directions on the cable. So the fact that you've got at some particular point maximum voltage and zero current is not a violation of any real energy flow, because no energy was delivered to that load, the open circuit.
Dick, voltage is not a problem, because voltage is potential. Current flow, based on the diagram that I have sent you, maximum current, 180 degrees out of phase between two wires, just for the current curve. Now we have a zero voltage, just theoretically. What is happening there?
You got to be careful now. Some people think that they must measure voltages at various places to calculate power. Other people think you must measure current at various places to calculate power. Which group of people are right? You could say both, or you could say neither. at any particular point on the cable, there is a forward-flowing wave with some voltage and some current. There's a reverse-flowing wave with some voltage and some current. E crossed H as a vector cross-product multiplication tells you something called the pointing vector. The pointing vector tells you the amount of energy that is flowing in that direction at that time. If it was a wave flowing in free space, there is something you and I call voltage, but the free space people call it the E field. There is something called current, which creates a magnetic field, and the free space people call it the H field. But there's a strong correlation between all these fancy names. But the voltage waveform in free space, the current waveform in free space, are at right angles to each other. You do a vector cross product multiplication. You multiply E crossed H. You generate a arrow, which is the so-called pointing vector. The direction of that arrow equals the direction of advancement of a right-handed screw thread. So if my waveform in free space, I'm going to relate this back to a cable, don't worry. If my waveform in free space is vertically polarized, and if at this particular point in space I make a measurement, I stop time, and I make a measurement, and I find out the voltage is going up toward 12 o'clock, it's a vertically polarized waveform, and it is a 1 volt in my particular measurement system. And I make a current measurement in that particular free space point, and the current is going toward 3 o'clock, and it's 1 ampere in my crazy example. And now I multiply in a cross-product vector multiplication technique, I multiply E cross H. E cross H means I take the arrow of voltage, which is toward 12 o'clock, I multiply it of the arrow toward of current, which is toward 3 o'clock, and I move from the 12 o'clock position toward the 3 o'clock position. That's what cross product does for you. I'm crossing E into H. I am making a right-handed motion with my hand that does that. That is the direction of advancement of a right-handed screw thread, and therefore directly away from me is the pointing vector that tells me the direction of propagation of that wave in free space. And now, if that wave was going toward a flat sheet metal wall and making a standing wave, I now have a wave going forward toward the wall, I have a wave coming back toward the wall. The wave coming back toward the wall, if I choose the right point in space, when I reverse my position, my back is now against the wall and I'm looking forward, the wave flowing back away from the wall, I could again see something at 12 o'clock, which I call E. I could see something at 9 o'clock, at 3 o'clock from my point of view, which I call H, E cross H. Now the reflected wave has a pointing vector in exactly the opposite direction. If I didn't move my position, if I didn't move my body, the forward going wave, both of them have at this particular point in space a voltage that is toward 12 o'clock. The forward going wave and the reverse going wave have a voltage going toward 12 o'clock. But the forward going wave at that point in space, at that instant of time, has a magnetic field toward 3 o'clock. That's the forward going wave. The reverse going wave has a magnetic field toward 9 o'clock. Because I've chosen a point in space where the forward going wave and the reverse going wave are constructive, they both have a voltage waveform toward 12 o'clock. They add together, I'll get twice the voltage. The current waveform, the forward going wave has a current waveform going toward 3 o'clock. The reverse going wave, reflected off the wall, has a current waveform going toward 9 o'clock. The 3 o'clock vector, the 9 o'clock vector, they cancel each other, and I think I see zero current at that point. If I dumbly make the measurement with a non-directional current meter, if I made it directional, if I used an instrumentation that senses forward power without sensing reverse power, I'm using a directional coupler, which is something you can definitely use on coaxial cable, then I will see only the forward going wave. I will see no voltage minimum points and current maximum points. Or if I use the kind of a sensor that measures only forward going current, which is sort of what's going on with the Berg wattmeter slug. If I'm in a directional manner measuring current, I will see points of, I will see equal current everywhere in space, if you know what I mean. So you think you've got a cancellation of current in certain places. You think you've got a cancellation of voltage in certain places because you've used instrumentation. Let me drop. That is not directionally sensitive. That is mixing the two together. And therefore you see the constructions and destructions. But at each instant in time in that wave in free space, there is real energy flowing. At every point in space, there is a magnitude of voltage and a magnitude of current, and at every point in space, I can cross one into the other and calculate exactly how much energy is flowing. Well, in that waveform that's going through free space, you go the next step of making a beautiful computer-generated graphic of what it really looks like. The energy of a waveform flowing in space looks like beads on a necklace, if you know what I mean. It looks like pearls on a necklace. There are little bundles of energy with zero amounts of energy in between, and they all move at the speed of light. Complicated system. When you take that wave in free space and force it to go into a coaxial cable, instead of the voltage waveform being straight up and down for a vertically polarized wave, in the case of the coaxial cable, the voltage waveform is always going from the center conductor toward the outer conductor. So it's a radial waveform, and there's a voltage waveform at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, all the way around. At every one instant of time, at the instant of time, I stop time and I'm looking at the place on the cable where the voltage on the cable at that point is positive. And there's a current flowing on that cable. The current is flowing away from me on the center conductor and toward me on the outer conductor. And the two have to balance each other. But there is real energy at every point along that cable. You can figure out what is the voltage and what is the current. So when it comes to the socket in the wall, when you've got 110 volts, or if you're in Europe, you've got 230 volts, you think that voltage there has no energy to it. No energy is flowing because you haven't connected a load yet. Therefore, no current is flowing. The voltage can be there, and there is no current. Therefore, no energy is flowing until you connect that light bulb, so to speak, to...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And by the same token, if I put a dead short circuit on that socket, and if I didn't blow the fuse in your house, your circuit has got enough current capability, I've now got a dead short circuit, I've got a huge amount of current flowing, but there's no voltage at the place where I put the short circuit. So if I've got a low enough resistance piece of wire that I did that with, and I'm making a huge amount of current, but the voltage is zero, no energy is being transmitted. The voltage is zero, the current is high, the product of the two is zero. If I didn't put the short circuit, I got a perfect open circuit. The voltage is high, the current is zero, the energy is zero. It's only when you put something intermediate, it's got to be greater than a short circuit and less than an open circuit, for you and I to have reasonable amount of energy flow that we can measure without blowing a fuse or without doing nothing. I know this doesn't answer the whole question, but maybe it makes it a little bit easier. But bear in mind that every position along a transmission line that's the grid for the United States, or every transmission line that you and I use for our coaxial cable, the only way you can calculate the energy is that you must know the voltage at that point, the current at that point, and the phase angle between the two. And if you're smart, you better separate the forward-going waveform from the reverse-going waveform, keep them separate when you do that calculation, and now you know how much energy is flowing up the cable and how much energy is flowing down the cable. So if you're naively enough using non-directional instrumentation, and you simply measure a point where the voltage is zero and you think no energy is flowing up and down, you're naive. Or if I go to a place where it is zero, but the voltage is maximum, and I think no energy is flowing up and down that cable, again, I'm naive. So energy is the product of voltage and current and the phase angle between the two when you consider the wave in one direction at a time. And there are ways you can look at both directions at a time, but you better be careful, because sometimes you come up with zeros that are not really zero. It's not as simple as it looks. What else is new? I know that John wanted to make a comment on this. KC2WGB. And by the way, we completely skipped over the mailbag. Oh, boy, did we goof. KC2WGB, K2RAW. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Dick, I try to remember to tell Wesley to come after Paul so this doesn't happen. But according to this, what we're talking about right now, if we had a supply and a load, and whatever we have to do with the load, we make a standing wave, and we have this piece of twinning. Okay, I think you're both forgetting one thing. If I were to take a millivolt meter and on a single wire separate those probes, I'm going to read a voltage drop, a difference in potential. I don't care where his nodes fall, there's current flowing in that wire. I think that's pretty simple.
Yeah, I think you're saying that if we took your slotted line, which is beautifully pictured in your QRZ.com website pictures, if I took that 805 kilopacker slotted line, and if I put one voltage probe at the 30 centimeter position, and a second voltage probe at the 40 centimeter position, and I looked at the voltage difference between the two when the signal is flowing down that cable, down that slotted line, and you got a perfect 50 ohm load at the far end of it, I will see a potential difference. You got to be careful how you judge that, though, because the length of your wires, the extra inductance you measure there, calibrating that system would be a little bit difficult. But rarely do we ever pick two positions along a transmission line, you know, the 30 centimeter position and the 40 centimeter position, and put a voltmeter between the two and measure the voltage. Rarely do we do that. And you will get a voltage, and interpreting it is not easy.
No, Dick, I'm not saying across the two of the twin leads, only on one conductor to measure the voltage drop, which proves his current flow.
Yeah, I think I see where you're going on that one, John, and that's a difficult measurement. In order for you to, under normal circumstances, put instrumentation along one wire of a twin lead and make a measurement, unless you're very careful, your instrumentation is disturbing the characteristic impedance of the cable in that area, and the disturbance you make may make a bigger voltage or current difference than reality. There are ways you can do this.
But not at 60 cycles, Dick.
That is correct, not at 60 cycles. And when you put a probe, the way that it's constructed with the slotted line, if you put two of them in different places, that's what he's, I believe, asking for.
Okay, let's assume that there is a 100 kilovolt high tension line out in front of my house, and assume that I'm smart enough to not electrocute myself when I go up there on an insulated ladder, and I've got this voltmeter. I've got my thoroughly shielded digital voltmeter, and I've got the two probes in my hand, and I connect one probe along that wire as far as I can reach with my right hand, and with my left hand I reach as far as I can, and I connect the second probe, and now I start taking a reading on that meter. And at first you would say, okay, there's 1,000 amperes flowing in that 100 kilovolt line, and therefore I'm going to get some number of millivolts of drop across those two. That is true. However, bear in mind that the way I connect my meter will make a difference in the way I read it, even though I've chosen the positions. Because there is a significant amount of current, 1,000 amperes, flowing in that wire, because there is a certain area between the wiring to my digital voltmeter and the main line itself that I'm measuring on. In other words, I didn't slap my digital voltmeter straight flat against the wire that I'm measuring, and my leads themselves have a certain distance from that wire. There's a certain area between the two. Because there's 1,000 amperes flowing on that wire, and there's a significant amount of magnetic field lines wrapping around that wire, very similar to me putting my thumb on the wire and wrapping my fingers around the wire. That's the way the magnetic field is flowing around that wire with 1,000 amperes flowing through it. That 1,000 amperes of current magnetic field, circular lines going around that wire, are also encountering the leads of my digital voltmeter. That changing magnetic field at a 60 cycle rate is inducing voltage along the leads of my wires of my digital voltmeter, even though no current is flowing through them. My digital voltmeter's got a 10 mega ohm input impedance.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
My digital voltmeter has a 10 mega ohm input impedance, but that local magnetic field is inducing voltages. In other words, the main wire with 1,000 amperes is the primary of the transformer. The wiring to my digital voltmeter is the secondary to this transformer. And that magnetic field is inducing voltages into my wires going to my digital voltmeter. I think I'm measuring the voltage drop across 3 feet of that cable. I'm measuring something very different.
Yeah, but just think about 1 milliamp, not in 1,000 amps, and think about the soldering line, because that's what you're saying right now is that the probe of the soldering line is creating disturbance and transient.
As if I could tell the power company that has 1,000 amperes flowing in that wire, and because of the primary secondary magnetic field condition inducing voltages in the leads of my digital voltmeter, and therefore the voltage measurement I make is going to be phony as all hell. I'm going to measure some voltage, but interpreting it's going to be very difficult. And if I tell them to now turn down the current from 1,000 amperes to 1 milliampere, yeah, the magnetic field just got 1 million times smaller. The voltage drop got 1 million times smaller. The error of my measurement will be the same. I'm going to measure a huge measurement. So depending on how you set up your instrumentation, this is a very difficult measurement. The smarter thing I could do is that I could put a very small loop of wire parallel to this 1,000 ampere lead with 100 kilovolts on it. I'd put a very small loop of wire there where I know the area of my loop of wire. I know the distance from the cable. I know the way the magnetic field falls off by the laws of physics. I know the rate at which the magnetic field falls off as either a square law or a cube law as I go radial distance away from that wire. By way of the voltage I pick up with that loop, I can calculate the local magnetic field, and I can therefore measure the current on that wire. Once I measure the current on the wire, and because I know the wire is made out of 6061T6 aluminum, and I know how many thousandths of an inch diameter is the wire, I know the gauge of the wire, I know the resistance of the wire in ohms per 1,000 feet, if you know what I mean, that would be a much more accurate way of calculating what voltage drop is occurring across that wire. So just go there and directly make the measurement with my digital voltmeter. I guarantee I'm going to see probably 50% error. You see where I'm going on that one, John? As simple as that sounds, it's a very difficult measurement.
Is the probe of the slotted line creating any kind of disturbance to the measurement?
And because that measurement is so difficult to make at 60 cycles,
you repeater, timeout.
Because that measurement is so difficult to make at 60 cycles at 1,000 amperes, you think that if we go up to 3.5 megacycles on twin lead, it's going to be any easier? I wonder if you can see a little bit of a picture as to how difficult it is. What I've envisioned as a way of getting around this, John, is that if I take magnetic sensing device, like I put a magnetic sensing current into the middle of a RFID tag, and I tape the RFID tag to the 1,000 ampere wire, now I can remotely make measurements because there are no real lead lengths, if you know what I mean. I wonder if some of that makes some sense, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, but we overcomplicate it a little bit. I mean, we could use a Hall effect device. But what I'm saying is, all right, let's take a clamp on ammeter. I don't care what you do with it. You slide it up and down that wire. You're not going to find the zero point, which is what we started to talk about. I understand what you're saying about it, the difficulty in the measurement, but you are not going to find a node in that wire.
You're absolutely right, and there's a beautiful explanation for that. Let me drop. That signal is S1 at my location, so it's a very low, it's a very weak signal, and we're probably going to time out. You never, if you could set up
S9 in my location.
Okay, that's very good. S9 at his location, S1 at my location. That gives us a little bit of a hint as to where it's coming from. And I can tell by the variation that it is a moving vehicle.
He is just passing around my house. Now it's full scale.
Repeater, timeout.
I want to talk to me!
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Wesley, do you have your preamp on?
Yes, I switch off the preamp, 9 plus 20.
That's good to know. That tells us how close it was. Okay, you would, with your clamp-on ammeter, on that 1,000 ampere 60 cycle, 100 kilovolt line. You could measure a point where the current goes to zero, John, if and only if you set up a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Now, for you to set up a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio on a 100 kilovolt line, oh boy, it'd be burning up generators. You couldn't do it. There's a whole bunch of reasons why, in the case of power generation and power distribution and power transmission of a grid circuit, you've set up that circuit very carefully so that the lowest possible impedance is at the signal generator, at the power station. You try to make the power station 1 nano ohm of impedance. And the customers out there, you want them to be 1,000 ohms or 100 ohms of impedance of their particular light bulb. So you want all of the voltage drop to be on the light bulb and none of the voltage drop to be at the signal generator, the power station, because he's a nano ohm if they've done a good design. In the case of the signal generators that you and I use, the signal generator has a very carefully designed 50-ohm resistor in it. That signal generator, as long as you're using the output attenuator at anything more than 0 dB, 10 dB or above, you make some careful measurements on that signal generator. You look back into it with a network analyzer, and you find out it is a 50-ohm source. As such, when you put a perfect short circuit across the signal, across your coaxial cable coming out of that signal generator, depending on the length of the cable, if the cable happened to be a multiple of a half wave long, the short circuit you put at the far end will be a short circuit right at the signal generator. And the signal generator with its 50-ohm series resistor does not burn up simply because you put a short circuit on the output of that signal generator. Your laboratory signal generators can easily tolerate a perfect open circuit, a perfect short circuit, and everything in between. A real power generating station cannot tolerate that because he's a nano ohm. But if he could, if you could really put a perfect short circuit on that 100 kilovolt line in New York, and assuming there's a half wavelength of that wire between New York and Michigan, where the main power station is, and you choose the point midway between the two, you would see a voltage maximum twice as high as the voltage normally being generated by the power station, and you would see zero current, because there would be a wave going from Michigan to New York, reflecting off the short circuit in New York, and going back toward Michigan. You would find a point of zero current with your clamp-on ammeter, because your clamp-on ammeter is measuring the forward-going current and the reverse-going current and mixing them together. If you used a directional coupler type of pickup loop, and there's ways you can set up a pair of a pickup loop so that they are a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
There's a way you can set up a pair of coupling loops, a quarter wavelength apart, coupled together with a quadrature hybrid, which gives you another quarter wave of delay between the two. You can make a current sensing directional detector on the outside of a coax cable. I have done it. It's a beautiful, successful experiment. The reason I did it is because when you build antennas that you think are balanced and they're really not balanced, when you install a balancing device and you think it's a good balance and it may not be so good a balance, the net result was you end up with current flowing on the outside of a coax cable. To simply take a 50-ohm coax cable, connect the shield to one half of your dipole and the center conductor to the other half is a very unbalanced condition. You're going to be forcing current to flow back down the outside of that cable. With this pair of current loops into a quadrature detector that I just described, you can now sense exactly how much current is, and measure it quantitatively, how much current is flowing down the outside of the coax cable. As you put on various balans on the end of that cable that connects it to the antenna, you can now find out the quality of those balans, and I've done that exact experiment. So there are ways that you can measure current in a directional detecting manner. Your clamp-on ammeter is measuring both directions at once, just like that probe on your slotted line measures both directions at once. I wonder if that makes a little more sense, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
KC2WGB. Well, when I go back to my original phone, if you wish, and a 10 ampere line, and I've done this with number 10 wire and raise the current, lower the current, I can measure voltage drop on that wire. Now, maybe I'm not getting exact readings, but I will not find, with that method, I will not find a zero point on that wire.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, we're back. John, as I see it, the clamp-on ammeter, you're saying that you've never seen zero current on it, and I agree with that.
No, not with a clamp-on. With a regular, like a Simpson 260, the clamp-on, I agree with you, because you're going through magnetic field variations, measuring one part of that wire, and measuring voltage drop across the wire with a regular ohm, will not show any zero points.
I agree with that. Let me think about that now. You have never set up a... You only get a zero point, John, if you have a perfect one-to-one standing wave ratio. I said one-to-one, perfect infinity. In other words, there's got to be a perfect short circuit on the far end of the wire. There's got to be a quarter wavelength of distance between that short circuit and the point where you're making the measurement. And there's got to be low loss, no loss in the wire. There's got to be no loss in the wire. There's got to be a perfect short circuit at one end, and you have to be a quarter wavelength away from the short circuit in order to make that clamp-on ammeter measurement or your voltage measurement. Then you would see zero. In any reasonable power supply you and I have ever used, it cannot tolerate a perfect short circuit and still generate power, so to speak. It's not doing it at RF frequency. By the way, the measurement you're describing is a DC measurement, and we're right now describing a RF phenomena. Only when you've got a real frequency of operation and a quarter wavelength away from a perfect short circuit on a lossless wire do you get this condition where there would be places where there's a voltage minimum and a current minimum when you use non-directional detecting devices. So there's a lot of caveats in there as to why you haven't seen that.
I was measuring AC voltage, 60 hertz.
Yes, but I know you are not a quarter wavelength away from the short circuit. A quarter wavelength on 60 hertz is roughly 500 miles. You weren't 500 miles away from the short circuit, John. Back to you, John.
Okay. KC2QIQ with a comment on this one, Dick?
Yeah, go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, John, one of the things that differentiates, just standard wiring in a power circuit versus a transmission line is wavelength to the length of your wire. In other words, if you look at a set of wires at 60 cycles, generally the frequency of your signal, the wavelength of it is so long and your wiring is generally short. In the terms of RF and RF, VHF, and microwave frequencies, the wavelengths are very, very short compared to the length of the wire, which is very, very long. So generally, when the wavelengths are short and the cables are long, we usually call that transmission line. And when the wavelengths of the frequency are so low and the wires are short by comparison, then it's just standard wiring. KC2QIQ.
Yes, so to be a quarter wave away from the short circuit would be roughly 500 miles. You are not 500 miles from that short circuit, John. KC2WGV, K2LIW. All three of you, go ahead.
Okay, Dick. Well, the issue is, and I know what you're saying, Glenn. Electrons are not
probably one block or two blocks away.
From the repeater site?
Roger, Dodger. Yeah, that means he's running very low power, but he's very close. He's within a couple of blocks of that repeater. So it's the quarter wavelength of distance required to see these standing waves. And on 60 cycle power, you never have the quarter wave. Does that make a little bit more sense, John? KC2WGB, K2RIW?
Yes, Dick, I understand what you're saying 100%. I just wanted to bring up that point of the fact that contiguous wire, continuous current, the zero point.
Going current and the reverse going current, you're absolutely right. But in a very high standing wave ratio RF situation with a non-directional detector, I will be able to find places where it looks like the current is zero. Or I'll find other places a quarter wave away where it looks like the voltage is zero. And because I'm mixing forward going and reverse going, propagating signals, I will measure those zeros.
Yes, I agree with you 100% on that basis of what you're stating now. Yes, of course.
And are they really zeros? Are they really zeros is a darn interesting question, as you can tell. And it's not clear. And, boy, lots of hams have argued over this one for a lot of years and have a lot of misunderstanding on it. It's not an easy subject. Let me see if Paul is available. WS2N, Paul, are you with us, and is there a report tonight from National Aeronautics and Space Administration? WS2N, K2RIW.
Can I take something very quick concerning the radio?
Yeah, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I forwarded you an email that I sent to James to that radio, and what I wanted to say is also I'm going to ask him to please come on this tech desk and talk to me and you, because, you know, before he does anything, you know, that radio has high voltage in it.
Yeah, but it's got a cage on it that he's not going to open up. I think he's got some respect for high voltage. With the cage that's on it and the power supply with its proper wiring, it's a relatively safe thing if used as recommended. If used as recommended by the instruction manual. Is that true, Rich?
Yeah, but Dick, you got to remember that.
Reverse S1 in my location, using low power.
Yeah, he can get away with very low power with the next and he keeps sort of zipping back and forth. The area of that.
Stand by a minute.
operational, or was that just recently enabled? NY2H, K2RW?
Apparently just connected it to the reflector.
Very good, thank you. So, it looks like by this means, John, you would have to continue. Because people are hearing what's coming out, why don't you go to the mailbag right now? KT2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. I hope our youngsters, these are coming from younger hands, I believe. I have a Bob who had an interesting question. And this is coming from Nell's Corner by by way of me. All right. This gentleman has an issue. And this is something we discussed, I think it was 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. We went into a description of a Heterodyne receiver and know how it developed and what it was used for and how it operated. This gentleman is asking the difference between something he heard called a TRF radio, and the first design. So if you, this would be nice to get the transition from TR to Heterodyne and know how the tracking capacitor works and things like that. If you could give a short dissertation on that, I think it would help this gentleman understand exactly where that term came from and why it's not used today. Basically, not using the word. KCWGB, back to you, Dick.
John, you can bring your audio up a little bit. It is slow.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. The audio could be a bit louder, John, and it has to be quite a bit louder on the 450 link to come through this particular one. So if I understand correctly, you want to compare TRF-type radios to superhead radios. And what is the advantage and disadvantage, and why did we switch over so that 99% of our radios are superheterodyne type and not TRF type? Is that approximately what Bob is asking, Bob? KC2WGB, K2LIW?
Yes, Dick, you heard the term TRF. He really doesn't know what that is, but he knows it has something, it seems to be the counterpoise to the heterodyne. So if you could explain how TRF was and what we had to do in those days compared to the heterodyne, which we're using today. And you covered the heterodyne pretty well a couple of weeks ago. So if we could get this down and why the transition took place and how it works. Basically, that's about it. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Very fine, John. You did pick up your audio quite a bit. However, let me see, do I get the right? Yeah, there it is. You picked up your audio quite a bit, but it could be even a bit louder, John. The very first radios done by Marconi, among other people, were TRF, tuned radio frequency radios. In other words, if you wanted to listen to an AM broadcast station at 1 megacycle, just a little bit below Winds 1010 New York, if you know what I mean, you had an RF amplifier tuned to 1 megacycle. You had about 6 or 7 other stages all tuned to exactly 1 megacycle. And so because the average radio has between the antenna and the final detector and the loudspeaker roughly 110 or more decibels of gain. 110 decibels of gain is, let me think now, 1 billion to 1 is 90. It's 100 billion to 1 power ratio is the amount of gain of all of those stages in between the antenna and the loudspeaker. And in order to tune to the 1 megacycle AM broadcast station, all of those stages up to the final detector that looked at the envelope, the amplitude of the signal, detected that envelope and converted it to audio. That's the amplitude modulation was the audio. Then it goes through a couple of audio stages and the loudspeaker. That's the easy part. When you decided to listen to a different radio station, let me drop. I was on the wrong frequency. When you decided to listen to another radio station, like at 700 kilohertz on the dial instead of 1 megacycle, 0.7, you'd have to retune every one of those RF stages. So the early radios, and I owned one of those ones, it was a great big wooden box with a whole bunch of dials on the front panel and great big air variable capacitors inside. You had to align every one of the dials to the exact same number. You'd have to tune every one of those dials with a whole bunch of fine gradations on them down to 0.7 on every one of the dials to move every one of those stages down to 700 kilohertz. in order to listen to that particular station. So it was a great big manual tuning process. I guess there are ways that with chains and belts and whatever, it could have all been ganged together as long as you can make all those stages properly track. The kind of tube you use for the RF amplifier and the kind of tube you use for the downrange stages might not be the same kind of tube for an ideal design radio. Therefore, the amount of capacitance of that tube wouldn't be the same. Therefore, the tuning and the tracking wouldn't be quite the same. You see some of the degree of difficulty. On top of that, all of those stages tuned to the exact same frequency with, let me pick a number, 90 or so decibels of gain altogether, is really asking for oscillation. If the very last stage of amplification before the envelope detector wasn't 90 decibels isolated, shielded from the front stage, then the signal after 90 dB of gain on the fourth or fifth stage downrange, if any of that signal gets coupled back to the input stage, the whole system breaks into oscillation. So you've got a very difficult shielding problem. You've got a very difficult tracking problem to tune all of the stages to the frequency you want to listen to on a TRF radio, tuned radio frequency radio. When Mr. Armstrong, I think it was, who invented the... when he invented the superheterodyne technique, the difference was that now the first one or two stages is tuned to the one megacycle or the 700 kilohertz signal that you want to listen to. That, in turn, is mixed with a local oscillator that if you were using a 455 KCIF frequency, the oscillator would be 455 KC higher than the frequency you want to listen to. If you want to listen to a one megacycle signal, the local oscillator would be set at 1.465 megacycles. Once that oscillator mixes with that RF energy in the mixer circuit after the first stage of RF amplification, and the difference in that frequency is 455, the 455 KC goes into the next tune stage, 455 KC, the very first IF amplifier. Now you can put as many IF amplifiers as you want together, all tuned to 455 KC. They do not have to be retuned when you go to another frequency. All you've got to do is change that local oscillator and the first RF stage. After that, all of your stages are, the IF stages are all fixed tuned with just the right bandwidth and just the right center frequency, and they don't move. And that makes life a lot simpler from that point of view. Second of all, since the real bandwidth of your receiver is usually determined by the IF stages, since those IF stages, by definition, are working at a much lower frequency, it is a lot easier to make very sharp filters at a much lower frequency. The bandwidth of a filter divided into the center frequency of the filter, that number is called Q. If I want to design a filter that is 10 kilohertz wide for AM broadcast reception, which might be a real case, 10 kilohertz wide filter, and I'm doing that to listen to a frequency of one megacycle, RF, if I did it with a TRF radio, 10 kilohertz divided into one megacycle is 100-to-1 ratio. In other words, that filter would have to have a Q of 100, and that's starting to get difficult to make. It requires great big capacitors and inductors in order to make a very high Q filter that sharp at one megacycle. And that's for a simple Gaussian-shaped filter. If I really wanted to make a Chebyshev filter, a filter that's got a brick wall shape to it, if you know what I mean, it would require a much higher Q yet, so it's very, very difficult. In the case of a superheterodyne radio, you're operating at one-third the frequency in this example, 455 KC. It's roughly less than one-third the frequency. So the filtering becomes 3-to-1 easier. The gain stages are on a different frequency than the RF stage, so therefore even if there was feedback because of lack of shielding between the last stage of IF amplification and the first stage of RF amplification, even if there was very poor shielding, the system would not break into oscillation because they're operating on different frequencies. Any 455 KC signal coupled back by mistake into the front end of the RF amplifier running at one megacycle, that one megacycle filter would not respond to the 455 KC signal
has leaped into it. So the advantages of superheterodyne is that all of the phages don't have to track. You only have to track the RF amplifier and the local oscillator, just those two stages. And one double-ganged 365 picofarad air variable capacitor was the usual way that was done. It's a very simple circuit, and everything else is fixed-tuned. Whereas with TRF, you're making all of your gain stages operate at a higher frequency. You have a much more difficult filtering problem. You have a very much more difficult tracking. You have a very much more difficult tracking problem. And you have a much more difficult shielding problem because of potential feedback and oscillation. So as soon as Armstrong invented the superheterodyne technique, it caught on like wildfire right away. And tuned radio frequency radios essentially ceased to exist after that. There's one slight example of it, one slight exception to that. And that is the kind of very simple radio that's used for an RFID reader, radio frequency identification tag reader. You could call that almost a TRF radio. It's a zero IF radio. There is no local oscillator mixer. There is no superheterodyne function per se. There is no IF amplifier. It's a very simple radio where the transmitting frequency and the receiver frequency are operating on one and the same. And a whole bunch of other very fancy tricks are required to make that work. So you could say there's a little bit of TRF radio sneaking back into the popular radio world these days, but that's a rare exception. So I wonder if that's some of what you think Bob is looking for, John. KC2WGB, try giving us a little more audio.
Dick, could I add a comment to this too, please? KC2QIQ.
Right ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I think a lot in the earlier days of radio, the frequencies were very, very low, especially in the days pre-Armstrong. I mean, radio frequencies were, around the 1 megahertz region. So to have basically the radio working without an IF in 1 megahertz, to create an audio signal was kind of like a pretty straightforward idea. But when the frequency spectrum started to open up and you wanted to get higher frequencies, the superheterodyne radio with the, using IFs, intermediate frequencies, became a much better idea and much more practical as the frequencies went higher. Back to you, the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Glenn has a very important point there. Very rapidly, the radio engineers discovered that there's a lot of merit in the higher frequencies. They used to think that the higher frequencies were useless, and the ham radio output is very rapidly demonstrated by talking with signals across the Atlantic Ocean, which they used to call the pond. When we talked across the pond, as we called it, and started talking into Europe on those higher ham radio useless frequencies, the radio engineers said, whoa, we may have made a mistake here. We may have given away something very valuable. And so eventually you're moving up to frequencies like 10 megacycles, 20 megacycles, 50 megacycles, 100 megacycles. If you try to design a TRF radio running at 100 megacycles, where you're making roughly 90 decibels of gain, with, let me pick a number, a 10 kilohertz bandwidth, and you're trying to do that at 100 megacycles, I won't say it's an impossible design to keep that stable, to make it all work, but with modern-day techniques and computer simulations, you might be able to pull that off, but it would be very difficult. With the hardware they had to work with in those days, in the 1910s and 1920s, when superheterodyne really started coming into its own, that would have been impossible. So as you go up in frequency, there had to be superheterodyne. To make a 100 megacycle radio, and let me pick a number, 1925, to make one RF stage at 100 megacycles, mix it down to, let me pick a number, a 10 megacycle IF, and then a little bit downrange to a second IF of half a megacycle, relatively easy to do. But to build TRF at 100 megacycles in 1925 would have been very close to impossible. But if you could do it, there was a lot to be gained. A 100 megacycle radio, a so-called 2-meter or 3-meter radio, you and I now know it's a very valuable frequency region. That's what we're using right now. KC2WGB, K2LIW. Over to you, John.